Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Artists Helping Artists. We are the number one art show on Blog Talk Radio. This is Leslie Seda in Southern California, South Pasadena, and I have my co-host on the line, Carrie Waller, who's far, far away. How are you, my dear?
I am good. It is 11 p.m. for me, so in Japan they would say kamba wa, good evening.
It's only 7 a.m. for me, so I have a. I'm going to get a lot done today, a lot more than you are.
I've already done my day. I don't know.
Personally, I kind of wish September 1st was already done. Today is the launch day of the September 30 Paintings in 30 Days Challenge. And I just want to say one quick thing, and that is, if you can't figure out where to post your painting, which seems to be a common issue this morning, go to my website. You can Google my name, Leslie Seda. You can go to sedastudio.com, and at the top of the page, you'll see 30 and 30. And if you click on that, there's a page with information on what to do, and then there's a link to the blog. If you go to the blog, you'll see that over 100 people have already posted their paintings today, which is great.
Wow.
And it's important to realize I'm a nice person, so you actually have 3 days to post your painting before that day closes. But don't get too hung up in the posting part, because it's all about painting. It's all about painting more and having fun. That's all I'm going to say. But I have a crazy theme, a very crazy theme. It's based on, I'm inspired by dresses made on Project Runway. It's completely crazy, I know, but it's very fun. So
I like it. I think that's really neat.
The hard part is, forget the painting of the paintings. It's doing the research, because I'm trying to list what episode and season they're from and remember who the designer was. Some of them I know, but other ones I'm like, who did that one again? So that's taking me a little longer than I thought, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's some good dresses on there, so that'll be fun to watch you translate, interpret.
It's very, very fun, so I'm having a good time. So what's new with you, Carrie?
Oh, I am still, fortunately the second typhoon that was supposed to hit us went north of us, so we didn't get more flooding, so that was really good, because the week before we had a typhoon come through and had a lot of flooding and a lot of people displaced from their homes. So most of them have gotten, all of them now have gotten to move back into their homes. So, and we avoided the second storm, so it's been good, and we had nice weather today. And other than that, I'm working on commissions and other crazy things. I feel like you a little bit. I'm doing event planning for my church right now, so I feel like
that's what you said.
Channeling Leslie a little. So
good for you. That's fantastic. Well, I'm glad there's no more typhoons, at least this week, headed your way. That's kind of scary.
Yeah, I hope not. I hope it
doesn't
go well.
Well, we are very fortunate today, thanks to my co-host, Carrie Waller, to have an amazing guest. Her name is Patricia McMahon Rice, and she began painting portraits and teaching art classes and workshops in the mid-1990s. Looking at your paintings, it feels like you should have been painting for like 100 years, but I know you're not that old. Growing up in Bethesda, Maryland, Patricia was fortunate to attend high school with an excellent art department. She studied drawing, sculpture, and printmaking. When she decided to pursue portraiture, she sought out portrait artists to study under, settling on workshops with Daniel Green and then Robert Liberace, I'm assuming is how it's pronounced.
Yes.
She studied classic methods and materials with Liberace since 2008, and learning to master the technique used during the Baroque period of painting in oil on copper has become one of her specialties, and we are going to talk about that. Her paintings have won numerous local and regional awards. In fact, she's won more recent ones than what we're stating today, but we don't want to spend the whole hour doing your bio, but this is unbelievable. In 2006, her portrait in oil, Daydreaming, was a finalist in the Portrait Society of America's Tri-State Portrait Competition, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. Then in 2009, 10, and 14, she won national recognition in the Portrait Society, members-only competition, for 2 pastel portraits and a portrait in oil. In 2014, she received a Certificate of Excellence in the Society's International Portrait Competition for her portrait on copper titled Lauren. A people person, Patricia enjoys meeting new clients and finding the right light and pose to capture the essence of each one. Having raised 6 children, she especially delights in painting children and easily establishes a rapport with children, allowing them to grow comfortable and to fall into natural poses. Wow. Portraits may be painted during a series of sittings or from reference photos. Aspects from several photos may be combined to achieve the best likeness and composition. Fabrics, reflections, nature, and texture are all carefully noted, capturing a true likeness, and that's the essence of her work. Patricia is a member of the Lorton Arts Foundation in Lorton, Virginia, which is LORTONArts.org. She has a studio in her home in Warrington, Virginia, filled with beautiful north light for painting, which can be visited by appointment. For information about commissioning a portrait or workshops and classes, visit her website at patriciaricestudio.com, and that's P-A-T-R-I-C-I-A. Rice, R-I-C-E, studio.com. Patricia, or should we call you Patty? Is that more your name?
Either one is fine. I'm comfortable with both.
Okay. Welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being on the show. Your paintings are absolutely incredible.
Thank you so much. Thank
very
you.
Humbling.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's amazing. And anyone listening to this show, you have to Google her right now and look at her unbelievable paintings. So, I really like your tagline on your website, and it talks about your unique and highly personal portraits. Can you tell us how you chose that and what that means in your art?
I think I heard the phrase once, and it resonated with me, and I thought that's really what I'm going for. I'm particularly drawn to portraits that tell a story, not necessarily the standard pose. I love something a little bit more representation, a little bit different in terms of that person's interests. And I guess growing up in a big family and then having a big family, we're a family of storytellers. We love to sit around the table and tell stories. And a portrait involves meeting a family and learning their story and telling part of that story in paint. And I enjoy that. I recently have finished 2 posthumous portraits, and each, you know, had a really a beautiful story behind them. Mm-hmm. And one of them is going to actually go on display during the ceremony for this former Vietnam vet who's being interred at Arlington Cemetery in September. And it was really just an honor to meet his family and hear his life story and try to capture something of the amazing personality of this man. So that's part of what really draws me to portraits.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm not a portrait painter at all, and I'm just in awe of what you do.
Well, I like to tell people, don't ask me to paint trees, because that's my weakness, is trees and bushes. And I have fellow artist friends who just absolutely amaze me with what they do with trees and landscapes. And I often have to consult with them when I have a portrait that involves those dreaded trees in the background.
So you touched a little bit about the military a second ago, and all of us on the show today have a common thread, and that would be the military. I'm married to a military member in the Air Force, and Leslie grew up as a military brat, and I've heard from Maria Bennett-Hawk that you grew up as a military brat as well.
Yes.
And
yes.
I heard at one time you had 4 children deployed at the same time.
Not quite 4 all at the same time. I grew up in a family that has a long history of both service in the military, but also medicine. And you can go back in my father's side of the family, and I think we have someone in the family who's fought in every single war since the Revolutionary War. There's actually a Minuteman.
No way.
In the family.
Oh, my gosh.
So lots of military, and so my father served in the Navy. He was actually a corpsman at Iwo Jima in World War II.
Oh, my goodness.
And saw the flag when it when it went up. He was on board ship and heard all the ship's horns. He was on a hospital ship. All the ship's horns started honking when they saw the flag go up. And he raced up on deck and saw it. And so he stayed in the military but finished high school, of course, and then college and medical school, long career in the Navy Medical Corps. My husband's family, his father flew for the Air Force. His grandfather was in the Marine Corps. My sister was an Army nurse, my brother-in-law an Army cardiologist. And then all six of my children ended up in the military and two sons-in-law. So I had two Army Nurse Corps daughters and three Marines. All three sons were Marines at the same time. And then my oldest was in the Air Force and then got out, completed her degree, and married a Marine. And one of my Army nurse daughters met an officer in the Air Force when she was stationed in Hawaii and married him. So that's the crew. The total number deployed simultaneously was never more than two, though when those two were deployed, they were both deployed to particularly dangerous areas. They were both in Helmand Province. One was a nurse with a forward surgical team, and the other was one of my Marines doing convoy security. And they were there during the peak number of casualties in Afghanistan in Helmand Province. And they both saw different sides of the war, but wrote very, very moving letters home. That were almost went back to another era. I have these handwritten letters that I saved because they're history.
Yeah, I have several from my husband to my boys, and my husband was deployed with his brother, and they were both in Afghanistan. So it's pretty at the same time. So it's interesting how these strong military ties to the whole family. His brother, you know, my father-in-law was in the military.
Right.
His father, and now both the boys. We'll see what happens with
my
boys.
Right.
So how has this impacted your art, all of this military history?
Well, when I got to the workhouse, and by the way, it's not the Lorton Arts Foundation. It's changed since I wrote that bio, so I my apologies. It's actually called the Workhouse Arts Center, and it's the former Lorton Reformatory, which was a notorious prison that was emptied, and then through adaptive reuse has been turned into an amazing arts center, and I lease studio space there. And I've been there since its opening in 2008. And it was in 2008 that my four youngest, all within a few months of each other, joined their two older siblings in the military. So that was kind of you talk about an empty nest. That was swept clean. And I'm not one to cry when they leave. That's the goal. That was the end goal. And so I actually really rejoiced that I'd made it. I wasn't sure I was going to make it at times with six of them, but I made it. I joined this art center. And with three sons, all in the Marine Corps, and these three sons could not have been more different growing up. They held themselves differently. They moved differently. Their personalities were different. They all went through that training, and I could hardly tell them apart in a crowd.
Oh, man.
And I was fascinated by that. And so one of the first paintings I did when I got to my studio was a portrait, and I believe it's on my website, of my three sons in profile, in their dress blues. I ended up doing it monochromatically. That was not my original intention. I wanted to put those beautiful uniforms in there, but I painted the three of them. And that piece marked a turning point for me because I didn't realize being so close to Quantico and Fort Belvoir and DC,
my dad was at Fort Belvoir.
Yes, there is a huge military, you know, both retired and active duty presence in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people who came through the buildings, and there are a lot of artists, there's a lot of art to see. They would just stop and look at this portrait, and then, you know, we'd engage in conversation. And I ended up beginning to do military portraits, and that was not necessarily my intention at the time. And so that's just one small example of how my whole art career has involved these wonderful twists and turns and unexpected opportunities. When my son, the middle son, was deployed to Afghanistan, he was involved in a large IED incident, and his driver and his sergeant were very badly injured. And my son, other than his hearing, was okay. And he is a childhood cancer survivor. And sending him to Afghanistan and thinking, you survived cancer. You weren't even supposed to. He wasn't supposed to live 6 months. No one has survived his particular diagnosis.
Wow.
And then he goes off to Afghanistan. There's this incident. 80% of the time, the gunner, which is my son, is fatally injured when there's this kind of scenario. Someone came through my studio, part of the MRAP task force, and explained all this. But my son had just ducked down inside prior to the blast, didn't know it was coming, and so he was really spared. And I thought, wow, two really close calls. And I was fascinated by this, so I ended up doing a painting of him on his MRAP in Afghanistan, and I'd just been exposed to painting on copper, and I thought, wow, the heat of the desert. Writers talk about a copper sky. I'm going to let that copper represent that awful wall of heat that's almost metallic in nature. And then the man and the machine, and it seemed appropriate to leave lots of bits of copper woven through the MRAP and even through my son in the painting. And that portrait, ended up, there was another whole story through painting that portrait of having an article in a military magazine about MRAPs and that kind of thing. So,
wow. That's an amazing story. Unbelievable. We lived in Alexandria and my dad was at Fort Belvoir. How funny is that?
And the
Pentagon. So I have a question. As we all kind of, start being artists and kind of figure out what we want to do, how did you end up doing portraiture? Was it something that you always wanted to do? Did you stumble into it? How did that happen?
I've done a lot of stumbling in my life, especially in my art career. I've backed into my best decisions. In 1994, I had no intention of being an artist. I didn't think I was good enough. I had six small children at home, and my next-door neighbor was homeschooling her daughter, who loved to draw. And she said, I couldn't draw a stick figure. Would you teach my daughter how to draw? And I thought, sure, I've always known how to draw. That's not that hard. So I started a class, and I filled the class, and then I filled another class, and by 6 months, I had seven classes running. And I thought, wow, this is a business. So I started this business teaching kids, and then Pandora's box was open. I was drawing and thinking about drawing and couldn't stop drawing, and I would draw till late at night after I put them to bed, and I drew all kinds of things. But I had always loved faces, and as I thought about trying to get an art career going, and this is more of a dream that I couldn't even admit to other people, but just inside me, that I wanted to be an artist. You know, there's this line you finally cross where you say, I am an artist. It took me a long time to cross that. And then to say, I want to be a portrait artist, and I want to be a great painter. That admitting that out loud and moving forward with that took some time and a lot of growing in confidence that I needed. The advantage I did have was at 19, graduating loving art as a high schooler and thinking about art school, but it was the 70s and art was representational portrait work was not enthusiastically supported at that time. I didn't have much confidence, direction, whatever. Well, there's a whale of a difference between a 19-year-old girl and a 40-something. I knew something about working hard, setting goals. I wasn't afraid of goals that were 10 years out. And I, at that point, began to crystallize what I wanted to do. So at some point, probably, so that was 1994, probably by 2000, 2002, 2003, that was when I really just came right out and said, family, friends, everybody, this is what I want. I'm going at this 2000%.
Good for you.
And with the kids older, there were a lot of things that I said, okay, I don't mind no longer doing these things in order to devote a lot of time to painting. When I joined the Workhouse Art Center, I was teaching 4 days a week and painting 1 day a week. And within about 6 months, I realized I needed to turn the Titanic, and I needed to paint 4 days a week and teach 2 days a week. Mm-hmm. And I made that change. And then within a year, I had my first national award. And that was the change that had to take place.
That's fast. That's unbelievable. Wow.
Right.
Well, it doesn't feel fast to me. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of hours. I think at the workhouse, I logged the requisite 10,000 hours, which is, I think, really what you need to become an expert in something, you know, according to that book. I'm a firm believer that if you want to be excellent at something, do the time. Do the time. And don't make excuses for not doing the time. I made a lot of excuses.
I agree with you. You have to have a mindset, too, that you're going to do it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
When you make that decision, that's a big decision. And it means a lot.
It does, and it has repercussions in all the areas of your life because my girlfriends had to understand, no, I'm not really available to, at the drop of a hat, go off and have lunch or, you know, even gardening. I love gardening, but I ended up bartering with a student, her classes in exchange for her doing my garden. So I could still have the gardens. I just didn't have the time to do it. I had to lay a lot of other things aside.
So you paint in oil and pastels. I don't know if there's anything else, but I know those. And do you have a preference between, you know, any of those?
You know, a lot of people ask me that. The oil took the longest to learn, 6 years of bad portraits before I even had a product I could begin to market.
That's going to be encouraging to so many people. That's going to be really encouraging.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was fumbling along, and I think part of my problem was that I thought I could figure a lot out myself or at taking classes, say, at the community college or someplace like that. It wasn't until I decided that I needed to find portrait artists who were really good at what they did and good at communicating how they did it. And that was when the change began to take place. Color is not my natural gifting. The skill that I am intuitive with dates back to what I studied growing up. Printmaking, sculpture, and drawing all have the same thought process. Push it in, pull it out, dark, light, negative space, positive space. Color is a fourth dimension to me. And I think that's part of why I struggled so long with that. But 6 years of bad paintings are stored in my basement, and then things started to crystallize. So when I complete an oil painting, I feel like, oh, my gosh, I managed to do it again. How on earth did you do that? What a struggle. When I work in pastel, that's because I use a lot of pastel pencils. Mm-hmm. Somehow that comes a little more readily to me. And probably also because pastels come in an array of sophisticated colors, where with paint, you're using more limited palette. You better know you got to have some serious color skills to take that limited palette of paints and put together some sophisticated color. And when I watch my instructor paint, I do not watch what he does on the canvas as much as I watch what he does on the palette. And I'm always so surprised to see him grab one color and grab another, and then all of a sudden he's got, a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of that. And then I look at the color and say, that's how you came up with that. Holy cow. No wonder I have trouble doing this. You know, a little of this and a little, it's kind of like a cook who knows how to add spices instinctively, and they grab a pinch of this and a pinch of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's to me, that's what painting in oil is like. So pastel feels safe. I know I can always kind of hit it out of the ballpark with pastels. So when I'm wanting something safe, I sit down and do the safe, have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and my commissions are in both areas, so I go back and forth.
Okay.
So I sit down at the easel with the oil paints, I have to pray before I start.
You know, you mentioned commissions, and so many portraiture artists obviously work in commissions, and commissions are one of those things that they're kind of a necessary evil for a lot of artists because they can be very, very stressful. And I'm curious if you have any advice for artists regarding kind of the process that you use, the contracts that you write, some of the pitfalls, some anything, because the commissions are tough. They really are.
They are. They really are. I have a love-hate relationship with commissions, and everything that I do now is based on a mistake I made in the past. And almost every commission, I learn something, and I say, well, add that to your list, you know, or whatever. Tweak your contract to include this or that. So it tends to run a little bit more like a well-oiled machine now. I hear a little beeping on the phone. Am I okay?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't hear
it. Okay, good. All right.
We don't hear it.
You don't hear it. Good.
Mm-mm.
So in terms of the commission process, I do things a little bit differently from some. I take a 20% deposit. I don't take as big a deposit as most people do. And I do that for a specific reason. Written in my contract is something that says, I will do my very best to not only capture a likeness, but create a piece of fine art for you. However, if at the end you are not thrilled with the portrait I have painted, you are not obligated to buy it. Your deposit is non-refundable. But I do not want a piece of my art hanging on someone's walls, like my mother has a friend who every time people come in this woman's house, she points to this enormous painting of herself on the wall and says, you would not believe how much money I paid for this, and it doesn't look a thing like me. And I don't want that kind of advertising. I would rather lose the money. But I also have written in there, the portrait belongs to me, and I have the right to display it in my studio. So I retain the artwork. Has anyone ever taken me up on that? No. In addition
that was my
to
next
putting
question.
That, yeah, there have been a couple close calls. I have one portrait that I actually just started all over, which I don't normally do that either.
Wow.
But that being said, I also try and really put in place that we have good reference photos. I have learned to say no to certain photos.
Yeah.
A lot of people in the early days would bring snapshots with flash photography, flat light across the face, blurry, distortion, all the horrors of photography have been handed to me. And people love this photo, and they have an emotional attachment to it. And I have learned to say no, because I cannot make a great painting if I am starting for horrible references.
Sure, of course.
It does get more challenging with posthumous portraits. I try to make sure that they bring a stack of photos, not just one, and that they tell me what it is about each photo that appeals to them and that tells them, this is my son or my daughter or my husband or my grandmother, whoever it is that I'm painting. And so I try to get a feel for what really is the essence of that person's face and personality you know, that they see in those photos. So stack of photos. And sometimes in the stack, there will be a gorgeous photo. And mm-hmm. I'll pull it out and say, why don't we use this? Here is why this works. At first, I was too client-directed. I am much more self-directed. And I have learned over the years how to express myself as an artist with a lot of confidence and educate them as to why this or that photo won't work and why the one I've picked up will and why it gives me the information I need to really create a good piece of art for them. They may not see a warm, cool shift in the skin in this one particular photo, but I see it and I know that's what I need to make a good painting. So I insist on good references. I've learned to take references, and I have a photographer who comes with me, and she stands where I tell her to stand, and she's a wonderful gal. She's willing to step into the water if she has to, or sit down on the ground and shoot up. She's endured all sorts of difficult circumstances to get the shot that I want, so she's very directable, and she has the skill that I need so that I can focus on getting that child or that group of people to look in the correct direction. And then I can go back and forth, moving an arm, moving a foot, shifting some shoulders so that I'm really composing this and she's recording it for me. So I have a great photographer. She is also an artist in her own right. So she understands. Turn that flash off. You know, don't, she knows I'm going for something other than evenly warm, flat light, which a lot of professional photographers, you know, that's what they're doing.
Right.
So I have a photographer, I have a good contract, I insist on good photos. And then last of all, towards the end of the painting, and I explain this to them early on, near the end, you need to come in and be willing to spend an hour in my studio while I'm painting. I want you to give me feedback about the likeness, and I will make minor changes, not like get rid of teeth when there were teeth in a smile kind of changes, but minor changes while you watch. And that does two things. First of all, they really do know that person, and they will see a very subtle thing in terms of the width of a lip or a nose or eye color or something that maybe I somehow lost in the process of painting. They will see that and point it out to me. And I'll sit there, and under their direction, I'll make those changes. I'll go back and look at the photographs. I'll remeasure. We'll look at things. And I find that involving them in that final process helps them to own the portrait too.
Of course.
They feel like they've had a role in making it perfect. So when they take it home, they in a sense they've approved it. But I also send it home saying to them, if a month from now or even 6 months from now, you look at it and say, why did I not notice this one thing? It's really bothering me. Bring it back. Bring it back.
And I'll
fix it. I will change it. Now, obviously, if you have to ship something, they ship it at their cost. And I take, you know, lots of photos when they have to approve it via photos. And it's still easily done now with the internet, with email, even with FaceTime, Skype, whatever you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can do those kinds of things. But I find having all of those structures in place, and I alluded to one that I also want to mention. Prior to beginning the painting, I print out a large black and white print that is the same size as what I'm going to be painting. And I usually actually print out several sizes, and I take it to the client's home, and we hold it up where they plan to put the portrait.
Right.
Because I want to make sure that this, it's the right size for the room. It's what they're looking for. And there have been times they've looked and said, oh, that's way too small. This is a huge room. We've got to go bigger. Or they look and say, wow, this is just not what I anticipated. This has to go much smaller. So we really confirm the size ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a black and white print. And see, that goes back to my core skill, which is value. And I always have that value photograph to look at. And then when
right.
I'm doing the painting, that black and white is up at all times. And I can get back from a distance because my color version better read with the same value. And that's the thing about color. You hear colorists say all the time, or painters, you can almost paint it any color you want as long as it's the right value. Now, that's not quite true of skin, you know, green skin, the right value tonight. But you better hit the value notes correctly to capture a likeness. So I always have that. And then if they say, well, is that nose really that wide? And I measure on my black and white print, and I measure on my painting. And if the nose is exactly as wide as it needs to be, then it has to do with how I've modeled the form and not how it was actually drawn on. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So those lots of mistakes made have gone into that contract.
Yeah. So you talked about you paint from life and from photographs, really. So can
yes.
you tell us the pros and cons of both for somebody that's trying to figure out, you know, doing the portrait artist
right.
thing for themselves?
Right.
Can you talk a little
right.
bit about the pros and cons? And, you know, it sounds like you prefer to do both, but maybe you can elaborate a little bit.
Yes. The commissioned work has been almost exclusively done from reference photos. And there have been times that I have brought my pastels and a small piece of paper, and I have done a little study to get skin tones, or especially certain eye color. The greens and the blues and the hazels can be near impossible to capture accurately in a photograph. So I'll do a little study, and especially since I do a lot of children, they're not going to sit still, hardly for photographs, much less
right.
for a painting. And but they will sit and they will play with Legos or whatever while I just peek at their eyes and they chat away. And it also gives me a chance to really get to know them. So I have that mental image in my mind when I'm then painting from the photograph. I used to print up photographs and print up enlargements and put them all around the canvas. And that was, the late 90s, early 2000. Now I have a laptop. And I can get into Photoshop, and I can shift the photograph warmer or cooler in different areas, knowing that I want, if I have a warm light source, I want to paint the lit side maybe even a little bit warmer than what's in the photograph. So I can
mm-hmm.
mess a little with Photoshop if I need to, or I can cool things or, you know, neutralize it and then look at it and think about that. I can zoom in. My eyes went from perfect vision the trifocals, and the laptop helps me enormously. And then I find it very, very useful to keep my iPhone there, and I snap pictures, and then I look at it, because all of a sudden it moves it away from you.
Sure.
And I get up, I move back, I look at it, I look at the photograph, and usually your mistakes are readily apparent in the photograph or moving back or whatever. I still find that I have to work from life every week, and that's one of the reasons why I've stayed in classes with Rob Liberace. We work from life all day on Fridays from 10 in the morning till 7:30 at night. And that discipline of working from life informs how I interpret a photo, and I am more and more in tune with where photos lie, because all photos lie. They all
so Patty,
lie.
Patty, do you have any, like a story of one of your commissions that you'd like to share, whether it was good or bad?
Oh, wow. Let's think about this. Gosh, I could just ramble. I'll ramble. I was commissioned to paint three boys in a family when each child turned five. And so I painted Charlie, and that was absolutely a delight to paint him. And then Charlie's younger brothers were actually identical twins. And it was very important for mom that the twins' differences in their appearance be captured, because there were just a couple little differences. One had a very subtle birthmark that had developed over time near his eye, and another one had a distinctive freckle on his throat. Now, otherwise, they look so much the same when you first met them.
Sure.
But when you watched them play and you interacted with them, their personalities were so different. And the one boy, Teddy, was just a teddy bear. He was just a contemplative, thoughtful, sit quietly, think about things, engage you in conversation. And there was Henry, who is just this delightful handful of energy and, you know, is just ready to, you know, dash off to the next thing. And so although both boys were going to be sitting in the same chair, the grandmother's chair, so this is, you know, part of an inheritance,
mm-hmm.
and I love to incorporate something like that in a painting. You know, have something that's a nod to the past, just as this piece is going to be, hopefully one day, the person who's painted is going to turn to a grandchild and say, I remember when I was your age and I was painted, and they're going to be part of the past. So I like mm-hmm. to link that all together. So here we had the same chair, and they sat in the chairs very differently. And it was a lot of fun to finally find a way to get those personalities within the chair. And it really worked, and that was a lot of fun. I think one of the hardest paintings I've ever had to do was while my children were deployed. The first Marine, young Marine from my hometown, was killed in the war, and he was in Afghanistan and it was an IED. And although I didn't know them, we had mutual friends, and I was approached by a group of people who wanted to honor the family and his memory about doing a portrait of their son, Sean Callahan. And when you paint a young man that's the same age as your young men, and he's wearing the same uniform your sons wear, and your children are deployed, and you pray for them, and you go to bed and say, I'm just going to sleep. I'm not going to think about what are you going to do if a car pulls up to the house. Because then you know what that means.
Right.
They did all the pictures of Sean were, you know, on his deployment, talking with kids, or, you know, there wasn't anything that would be a more formal photograph, which is what they wanted in uniform. And the only photo they had was that fresh out of boot camp, that standard photo they do of all the boys. And men, I should call them. I'm sorry. They're just, you know, it's like my boys.
Yeah.
But that standard photograph. And he had deployed three times already. And I watched this with my sons, and I saw it with John. They age at an accelerated rate with multiple deployments. Mm-hmm. And I needed to paint Sean the way he looked now, not the way he looked fresh out of boot camp. So I had to take all this stack of photos that the family gave me and look through them and age him. And then they, not the parents, but this organization, put together a uniform for me. And I put the uniform on a mannequin, you know, with that Purple Heart ribbon. And I cried my way through painting him. You just cry your way through it.
Oh,
and I
of course.
Somehow felt, knowing the family, one of the things that this family loves is music. And Sean loved to play guitar. And when he would come home between deployments, he would grab his guitar and just... And there was this one photograph of him playing guitar and he just has this a little kind of contemplative look, and you can just see he's lost in this music, and he's in heaven. He's in heaven. He's playing music, and that was his heaven. And I felt that somehow I had to incorporate that in the painting, and I decided near the bottom, vignetted, painted monochromatically, I would paint Sean playing his guitar. So it sort of breaks the rules of a formal military portrait, but I felt that I could do that for the family, knowing the family. And so I painted him. And for me, it was almost Sean comforting us, him singing a lullaby. It just felt like the right thing, you know, to put in there. So that was probably, that was definitely hardest painting ever painted. Biggest honor doing it for them. And I was there when it was presented to his mom, and it had only been a year. And the hug between mothers of Marines.
Yeah.
You know, that was she had a very fresh, very powerful, strong grief that she was dealing with that I could only in part understand.
Right.
So that's a happy story and a hard story.
Oh,
but
my
gosh. You know, every painting has a story, and it is an honor, you know, to tell it.
Oh, well, it's an honor to hear you explain that experience. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. And I hate to continue on to the next question, but we're going to do it.
Okay.
And that is, you paint on copper. And I'd love to know how you started doing this and kind of how you do it and how all of that works.
Okay, so a mini art history lesson. During the Baroque period, early 1500s to early 1700s, Dutch and Spanish masters worked on copper, primarily for miniatures and small works. It was readily available. It was relatively inexpensive, and it was highly transportable. So remember, no photographs. You could do little portraits on a piece of copper and easily take them places. People had special cabinets that they would open up, and they would have, almost like we'd have our photo albums, they'd have their little miniature portraits in them. What they didn't know then, but conservators know now, is that copper is the most stable surface you can paint on in oil. The expansion coefficient of the paint and the metal is the same. So I have actually gone to the National Gallery of Art and looked at one of these masters, and I saw his work all on display, both panels, linen, and copper. The panels and the linen had all the cracking and cupping that you associate with the painting from that time period.
Oh, my gosh.
And the copper looks like it was painted yesterday.
Wow.
Absolutely pristine condition. And so I've seen with my own eyes. I read the definitive book on this, Copper as Canvas, and I contacted the Rijksmuseum, and they confirmed, because they have a lot of works on copper, Dutch Museum, they confirmed that everything in Copper as Canvas is accurate, and that is the resource that they turned to about the work on copper. I was introduced to copper by Robert Liberace as a student of the old masters. He will often teach a workshop that focuses on a certain period of time, Renaissance portraiture. We learned about underpainting and glazing. Another time we did the Dutch Golden Age, and he touched on working on copper, and on one day we had a chance, if we wanted to work on copper. Spanish classical tradition, same thing. When we had the day that we studied Velázquez, you could work on copper. And I found that with my gifting being in value, I could underpaint on copper and then glaze the color on. And it was the best support for my weakness in terms of color. With every stroke of your brush, a painter makes four decisions. They're choosing a hue. They're choosing a temperature for that hue, a warm red or a cool red. They're choosing saturation, whether that red has been grayed down or neutralized or whether it's, you know, very vivid and pure and saturated. And finally, they're making a value decision. That's four decisions every stroke of the brush. And this at least eliminated one so that I could focus on the other three.
It's so kind of intimidating when you think about that. Wow.
It is intimidating. So I really loved copper. I love being able to underpaint on it. It's such a smooth surface. And then last of all, because it's so slippery with the first layer, and almost all my works, almost all of my works have been done from life on copper. When I am painting that first layer, and I usually work just with burn umber and a little bit of some kind of solvent, just trying to get a little bit of a sketch on there and then mix up a value scale with burnt umber and white, you know, and fill in the light areas. The drawing keeps slipping away from you. You keep losing the drawing. Now, at first, that could be frustrating to an artist, but I find that it makes me open to change and open to eventually getting a better drawing, because all too often we put a stroke on the canvas and then for some reason it's one of these monogamous, married till death do you part kind of things. You put that down and so that's the tilt of the head. And I'm not saying every artist is like that, but I had a tendency. It was harder for me to move it on canvas. On the copper, my first stroke might be right, but I'm sure I lost it in the process.
Yeah.
So 5, 6, 7, 8 times, this drawing's shifting, turning, shifting. And as I see something that looks a little bit better, I think, well, wow, I should stick with that. So you can get a really nice sort of calligraphic thing going on that you could let stay on the copper, paint in other areas. You can actually totally buff it off and go back to the copper. I love that. And I also have a terrible tendency to be a fussy, finish it all out to the edges kind of painter. And because the copper is such a unique surface, I often want the copper to show. And for that reason, it makes me sometimes leave unfinished edges that I think are actually more charming sometimes.
Yeah.
Where
do you get copper?
Excuse me?
Pardon?
I was going to ask, where do you buy copper? I mean, where do you get it from? I'm sure some people are going to be wondering.
Okay.
I don't paint oil, so I haven't looked, but I'm just wondering where you get this from.
Right. There is a website called basiccopper.com, and they have tutorials that you can watch on the various thicknesses of copper and what sheet thickness you want to purchase, and they'll ship it to you. However, I like to work on roofing copper, which is one of the heavier thicknesses. A thinner copper that you can cut with shears or even strong scissors, you can take that and you can mount that on a panel with something like, some kind of good glue, like, Miracle Muck or even Gorilla Glue or something like that. You know, put it on, weight it, clamp it. I've seen people, fellow artists that I know, sometimes wrap it around, they hammer it around and glue it so it covers the entire board, you know, some kind of thinner panel, masonite panel or gesso board, something like that. I prefer to just get roofing copper. It's heavier. I have to work harder. You have to go to Home Depot or one of those places and get some really strong copper shears, metal, kind of like metal snips with a longer blade to the scissors, not a short blade. And I use a wax pencil, which is a litho crayon, and sharpen it with a razor blade to a point. And I will mark out where I want to cut the copper and cut it. Roofing copper comes in sheets that are 3 feet wide by 10 feet long. And when I purchase it, it is coiled up and tied with woven tape, and it's the maximum capacity I can lift, and I probably shouldn't be lifting it. It is quite a bear to lift.
Wow.
Very, very heavy. So you have to get some help. And when you unroll it, it can be a lethal weapon sprawling open on you.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You unroll that baby very carefully in a large space.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will cut it down. I like to take something like a Teflon pad, a buffing pad, very stiff one, and I will buff the copper till it's clean, pink, and not shiny like a mirror, but more matte. And I will use a circular motion to do that, very tight circular motions. And I will also use emery cloth, which is a sandpaper that's attached to a heavy canvas-like fabric. And you can safely use that to sand all the edges and sharp corners, because if you get a little burr of copper, it makes a frightful splinter. And the copper can cut or poke. I never transport the copper in my car in the back seat or the front seat. For safety reasons, I always mm-hmm. transport it in the trunk or in my CRV, you know, under the shelf that they have there. You don't want to mm-hmm. hit the brakes and have that thing flying
sure.
through the car. And so I cut it down to size. I buff it. And then I've been experimenting with taking a propane torch that has MAP in it, M-A-P, and so that burns a little hotter. And I just have a little handheld torch. Again, I just purchased it at Home Depot. And using some needle nose pliers and a metal sink with the cold water running, I hold it over the sink and I turn the torch on and hold the torch up to the copper. Copper heats quickly and cools quickly in water. And I heat it, and when you heat it, it brings out a beautiful fiery patina. So you get reds and purples and oranges and brownish copper and sometimes even blues and greens. And so there are times that I bring out a patina, save that, and it's very unpredictable. It's a very sort of organic appearance. And I will look at a piece and say, wow, this would be perfect for this landscape or for this portrait piece or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So roofing copper, shears,
that sounds amazing.
A torch, and I quick plunge it underwater while I'm doing it, and then it will safely cool. It is too hot to touch. So needle nose pliers with insulated grips are what I use to hold on to one corner, and I burn part of it, cool it, and then turn it around, hold another corner, burn it with the torch. So some of my pieces are just buffed, and they start that pink color. The pieces that I did in 2010 that I consider my control pieces, exposed to the air but not water like rain, they're kept inside, those pieces have turned a beautiful, dark, classic, coppery orange. And so at any point when you like the patina, you just shellac your painting, and it will not change.
Hmm.
Many times I will cover everything and then scratch back through the wet paint with the end of my brush, and then you get these beautiful lines with a little ridge of paint. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And I, within a few years, Robert said to me, you know, you ought to make copper your thing. You really have sort of a knack for this. And I took that advice to heart and began working almost exclusively on copper in his classes from life. My upcoming show at the workhouse is going to be all miniature portraits on copper done in his class, or small pieces of fruit painted on little 4x4 squares of copper. And everything will be in a hand-gilded Venetian frame, which is another story, but I've been studying gilding and Venetian framing, where you paint egg tempera over the gilding, you emboss parts of the gilding, leave part of it matte, create a pattern, maybe say a Celtic knot or a winding vine pattern, and then you stamp into the frame as well, and you age it with some casein and add your fly specks, and a very simple frame turns into a beautiful sort of Renaissance era looking frame. And that is called Venetian framing with its gilding with sgraffito and granito. And so that will be my upcoming show, combining copper with hand-gilded frames.
Okay, I can't believe how amazing your paintings are, but what you go through painting on copper is just mind-boggling. It's amazing. But I want to ask you a quick question, and that is, what's your studio like? I think it's off-site. It's not in your house, but that's one of my favorite questions to ask artists.
I think I'm spoiled because I have a beautiful studio that we added to my home, and we added it because I was teaching 150 students a week, and my front door was getting replaced regularly, and the carpet in the house, and the powder room outside the studio looked like a pastel bomb had gone off in it on a regular basis. And I really needed a separate entrance. I needed a wheelchair entrance. I needed wash-up sinks that were separate from the bathroom. And so my husband, we had the shell put up, and then he finished it off, and we attached it to the kitchen dining room area with French doors. And so it's just a step away from the hub of the house. And it's just a beautiful space with north light. And that's where I was teaching. And then I joined the Workhouse Art Center. And I realized that I needed to be out of my home to be more productive. That even though I had this great space in my home, several things were happening. I was considered available when I was in my home studio.
Sure.
I was available to family, friends, neighbors, whatever. In my studio at the Workhouse Art Center, which is almost an hour away, I was
at work. My gosh.
I was in my office. I was paying money for that space, so I had to be there and earn money for that space. So getting that space outside my home said something both internally to me, but externally to my family and friends. They respected my time in the studio. They understood I was going to work. I couldn't just run home to do this or that or change a load of laundry or take something out of the freezer for dinner that night or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So, and not only that, but the Workhouse is open to the public. So people come through your open studio.
Yeah.
And so I had to explain to people over and over and over again, what do I do? How do I do it? Why do I do it that way? And I grew doing that. I grew in confidence, and I grew in awareness of what I was doing instinctively that I wasn't even aware of. I wasn't aware of the amount of emotion I put into the expressions on many of my portraits. People saw that and commented on it. I hadn't seen that. I didn't realize what I was doing. So a lot of things became clearer for me in doing that. That
interesting.
Studio is set up very differently from my home studio. That studio, I decided people needed to walk in there and right away be able to envision their portrait on their walls. So I needed to put not as much studio stuff. Yes, I have easels and drawing tables, but I needed some nice furniture in there. I needed a cabinet with a painting or two or three over it.
Mm-hmm.
I needed a nice rug. I got an oriental rug that I put in there. A nice place to sit where people could come in and actually sit down and talk. And I needed it to be, to convey, and this sounds terrible, but I needed it to right away give the impression, if I want something like this, I need to be willing to spend some money for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I didn't want people coming in saying, oh, I bet I could get some cheap art here.
Right,
I wanted to, just like when you go into a really nice gallery and you look at that gallery, you know, okay, I'm going to look at some great art, and if I want it, I'm going to have to pay some money for this.
Right.
I wanted people to have that same impression. So I had to marry workspace with those concepts as well. And so I, when you walk in the door, the first thing you see are my military portraits on the wall. I hung some shears over the prison windows, which were pretty hideous. I have a cabinet to the right, a wingback chair right in front of you, an interesting antique bench in front of the portraits where you can sit, and that kind of thing. As you turn into the studio, then to your left, you'll see the flat file with my pastels organized on it, an easel with a work in progress and tabourets near it. And then finally, you have to actually come in and turn around to see the junk, my three drawing tables with stuff on it, whether it's copper I'm cutting or, you know, whatever, and things stored underneath. And I also decided I would paint the walls, that I wanted the walls to have a color on it that was harmonious with my work and that also gave the impression of a home. So I have all of that. I even have a little refrigerator because I spend long hours. If you're going to drive an hour there and an hour back, I bring lunch and dinner, and I spend 8 to 10 hours in my studio. If I have a deadline, sometimes it's 12. So I have everything there to be comfortable, to welcome a client, to show them a wide range of portraits. All my drawing work is over the drawing tables, and it's not framed. It's just taped to the wall because I want people to come in and see this is an artist who's also learning. She's studying. This is all my old masters, silver point, red chalk drawings, charcoal drawings, sepia wash drawings. This is the artist in process. And then I have my pastels all together, the military and family portraits together, and then finally on the outside wall where we can also display work, I have all my paintings on copper. So that's my studio.
Now, do you teach out of your studio?
I am fortunate to be able to teach semi-private classes. So these classes are 3 students or fewer, and I usually only teach 1 or 2 a week. I don't like to do too many of those. But this is sort of for a select group of people, and actually Maria was one of those semi-private students. That's how we met. She signed up for a semi-private class. And these are people who are all working independently. They sort of know the direction they want to take in terms of portraiture. And I can give them some pretty one-on-one instruction in my studio. I also teach workshops in the classroom in my building, which is a much larger room with a lot of easels and stools and chairs and a model stand. And I have a class painting the portrait from life, underpainting and glazing, a 2-day workshop coming up there in September. So I teach there. Sometimes I teach all things wild and wonderful, wildlife and pastel. I love doing wildlife and pastel. It's kind of another fun interest that I do. And I teach that to all ages of kids and adults, and so I've had classes there. But the majority of my teaching is in my home studio. It's on Mondays and Tuesdays, and classes are anywhere from an hour to 3 hours long. I teach homeschoolers, after schoolers, and adults, and I have about 80 to 90 students who come on Mondays and Tuesdays.
Wow.
So I like to block things. I find I'm most productive if I reduce the number of transitions in my day. If I have a lot of transitions, time dribbles through my fingers. So I cluster things. So I teach morning to night, but I get it all done in 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can, you know, and the classes that I take, there's a reason why I take 2 classes back-to-back with Rob. Because if I have to drive all the way to Alexandria, I just want to spend the entire day doing it.
Yeah.
Patty, what's your definition of success? in your art career?
Okay, personally, I feel success. I feel successful with a portrait when it's delivered and I see the family get tears in their eyes, or I know that I've really pleased them.
Mm-hmm.
I just completed a portrait of the first in a family of three where I'm painting each child when I graduate from high school. And to capture Juliana and to have her look so beautiful, so confident, in a setting that communicates her, the colors she loves, and in a historic setting, you know, where near the area where she grew up, that I just come to the end of that and say, that painting is going to be in their family forever.
Mm-hmm.
I that is so satisfying for me. And especially if I know, see, I had a role in getting all those photos. I had everything I needed for light. There are times when I finish a portrait and think that was frustrating because I had less than what I needed to make something that
right.
meets my standards. Now, that's internally satisfaction. Where I want to be, that sort of gnawing edge inside you that says, your work is not good enough. This is what great work looks like, and you're not there yet. You've got to find a way to begin to work on your brushwork and these edges and a stronger composition. I'm surrounded by people in Rob's class who are amazing painters, and I see his work, and then I go to the Portrait Society, and I see the finalists, and I go online and look at work, and those images stay with me, and I think about them before I fall asleep at night, and they inspire me, but they also show me where I'm lacking. So do mm-hmm. I feel really successful yet? No, I really don't. I'm not where I want to be. But I do try to find satisfaction and joy in where I am now. Does
mm-hmm.
that make sense?
Sure.
Because otherwise you're constantly unhappy and dissatisfied. It's the nature of an artist to be probably more critical of your work than anyone else. And you have to let that inner critic play its good role of forcing you to reach higher, reach deeper, work harder, seek people to study with to improve. That's its role. But don't
mm-hmm.
let it rob you of the joy of being an artist today.
Yeah. So is there a typical Patty Rice day? What would that be like?
Okay, I kind of hit the ground running. I get out of bed and just can't wait. I am not a bathrobe or PJ person. In other words, I get out of bed and it's like dressed, you know, before anything else. Let's just get dressed, get going, head downstairs, pack the laptop bag, pack my meals for the day, and I head out. I try and remember my love of blocking things. Monday morning is the one day that I wear my homemaker hat. So on Monday, I will, you know, run around if I have a doctor's appointment or whatever, you know, do one of those errands. I go to the grocery store. I try and cook as much for the entire week ahead of time. Get that all in the fridge. I start teaching.
Okay, she's way too organized.
I know.
I'm so intimidated.
No. And then at 1:15 on Mondays, that's when classes start. So from 1:15 to 6:15. So Monday morning, that's, you know, dig out from the weekend,
mm-hmm.
get things going. And then teach Monday. Teach all day Tuesday, 9 to 5:30. I have a long break in the middle of the day over my lunch hour, so I have an hour and a half, and that's my day to finish any cooking I couldn't finish the day before. So I try to get that done. And then Wednesday, early out of the house, and I stay till the workhouse closes at 6. It often I am there till 7. Sometimes I'm there later if something really good is happening. Often the cylinders don't start really firing till I've been painting about 4 hours, and then I hate to stop. And so if it's still working, I keep going. If I hit a wall and I begin to realize I'm slipping, I'm getting muddy, then it's okay. It's just time to go home or take a break and work on something else. So that's Wednesday, Thursday. Friday, I'm up early. I commute with someone to class, and I'm in class. I'm not home till 9:30 at night. So we leave at 8:15 in the morning, get home at 9:30. And I spend all Saturday at the workhouse. Saturday mornings, kind of a special date with my husband, and then we have Sundays together. You've heard of golf widows. My husband is a studio widower.
I think our husbands know what that is. It's crazy.
Right.
Good for
right.
you. Well,
so,
Go. Noah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to go on to the next section.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so the way we like to end every interview with an artist is to ask the same questions, and the answers can be one-word answers. They're very, very short questions,
okay.
And it's just kind of fun to hear your perspective. So the first one is, what is your favorite art book?
Okay, Leonardo da Vinci's Advice to Artists. I love his love of anatomy, and it's part of what drew me to Rob. Rob actually got the class into the cadaver lab at Howard University, and we did studies from the cadavers and then brought those studies to the live model sessions and did drawings called écorcher drawings, where we dissect out bone and tendon and muscle. And I had alluded to all the medicine in my family with nurses and doctors, and I grew up with all that medical hospital talk. Had to learn a lot of it when my son was so sick with cancer. And so I love anatomy and physiology. I took it in college. So when he talks about muscles and the figure and bones, this book has a lot of that advice and his observations about the
Excellent.
Way muscles will gather themselves together and that kind of thing. So anyway, it's edited and annotated by Emery Kellen. I found it at a used bookstore. I just love it. It's drawings in there. It has a number of his drawings in there. But then it's so amazing to read this man who drew so long ago, and I feel like he could walk into my classroom with Rob, and he and Rob could just talk side by side and sound almost the same. So this connection with these past masters, I love it. And his advice just sounds so spot on. So I love that book and often pick it up. And I'm going to mention a second that's more a contemporary book, and that is Tony Ryder's Complete Guide to Figure Drawing. I love his drawings, and he is an incredibly articulate instructor. And if you want to understand the language of light, if you want to understand all the different terms and parts of light and begin to see them, Tony Ryder will teach you that in this book. So it's The Artist's Complete Guide to Figure Drawing by Anthony Ryder. And this book is still in print. And I just can't say enough good things about it. My instructor, Rob, says that what really energizes a painting or a drawing, what drives it, the engine behind that drawing, is that core shadow or terminator, which is that deepest part of the shadow between right where the light ceases and the shadow begins. That's the energy of a painting, right there.
Got it.
And you'll get that. You'll get that in Tony Ryder's book.
Excellent.
Okay. So what is your favorite paint color?
Ah, wow. Okay, I'm going to just pick a tube of paint. and that is Terra Rosa. Terra Rosa revolutionized my skin tones. And remember, I'm not a terribly good colorist. And so when I had to start with purer hues and then work hard to neutralize them to create believable skin tones, I struggled. But Terra Rosa is a great home base for skin. And Terra Rosa, if you can just add a little bit of Naples yellow or yellow ochre to it and then lighten it, and right away your skin looks really pretty lovely for skin in the light. And Terra Rosa handles all the cool colors that you would add to it beautifully. And so you can put any purple, blue, green, turquoise into it, and it really makes beautiful, cool shadows. So Terra Rosa, I think, is my favorite.
Excellent. Do you listen to music when you paint? And if you do, do you have a favorite Pandora station or something that you kind of go to?
Yes. For many, many years, I listened to Enya, and I still mm-hmm. love Enya. I have sort of a mix that I put together of Michael Bublé, mm-hmm. Natalie Cole singing her father's songs, mm-hmm. and Josh Groban.
Excellent.
Sometimes I have a little Sarah McLachlan in there, but I really enjoy those songs. If I'm energized and not struggling, then it's Michael Bublé and all that kind of thing.
Right.
And things are clicking along. If I'm having a harder time concentrating, then I need something that's a bit more like Enya, that's a bit more even, because I find more and more that I like silence. So I don't always have music on, and I have to be very respectful about playing music at the workhouse.
Sure.
So I can have music on when I'm working at home, but mm-hmm. at the workhouse, I have to. There are no ceilings. There are
right.
partitions between the studios, but no ceilings. And music has a tendency to echo up and over and almost be amplified in the studio across the way. So I don't play music there as often as when I paint at home. And by the way, on a side note, I love when we get a storm and we have a blizzard warning, which seems like we've had a lot of them in the past 5 or 6 years, because when a blizzard is coming, that is my excuse to go to the workhouse, pack up stuff to do a painting just for me, and I bring it home, and the whole time we're weathering the storm, I'm painting in my home studio with music up as loud as I want it, and I am painting just for me. And almost always those paintings are paintings for a competition. And that was actually how I painted my biggest, my most prestigious prize, was the painting of Lauren that I did during one of our Snowmageddons, where it was two blizzards back to back. And so I had 2 whole weeks undisturbed, alone in my house to paint that painting.
So whose art would you add to your collection?
Oh, Rob Liberace. But
of course.
I also love Kate Sammons. I actually own a piece of Kate's work. She has been a finalist in the Outwin Bootshever competition and a finalist at the Portrait Society of America. One of the things that the Portrait Society has is a fixed price auction every year during their conference. And artists who have been finalists or on the faculty are asked to donate a 6x9 painting. And they will do a little painting. They don't sign the front, they sign the back. And there are about, 60, 80 paintings that are donated. And they go on display on these bulletin boards. And you get to walk around for about 10, 15 minutes and preview the paintings. And they have random numbers underneath on a sticky, underneath each one. And then they begin the auction, and they auction off sections simultaneously. It's semi-bedlam, but it's fun. So each bulletin board, which might have 10 paintings, you stand in front of the bulletin board that has a painting you want, and they'll say, number 14, who wants number 14? And 5, 10, maybe 30 people raise their hands. You pull your badges off, they go in a hat, they toss them, they pull a name out, you get it for the fixed price of $250. So every year at the Portrait Society, I have gotten one of those paintings. And I have a Kate Salmons painting. This year I got a painting by Xin Yao Seng. He's a San Francisco artist. So that's H-S-I-N, Xin Yao, Y-A-O, Seng. I believe it's T-S-I-N-G. Anyway, you can Google his work, and it is phenomenal work, and I have one of his little portraits. So that's, I'm starting to make my own little collection of 6x9 paintings, and I'd love to add a painting by Rob to that. I also love one of my fellow artists in Rob's class, who's also, she's actually been a finalist in the international competition, and that's Susan O'Neill. And you can also Google her work. Her work inspires me very much, and I love to meet the artist, talk with the artist, or email the artist and know a little bit about their work.
Yeah. Patty, we unfortunately are going to head off the air in 3 minutes because we only have an hour and a half, so we are going to have to end our show. But before we do that, I wanted to thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing what an amazing story your art journey has been and where you're going. And, oh, my gosh, it's unbelievable. Absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
And Carrie, thank you so much for being my co-host.
You are welcome. It's always a pleasure.
I know it's late there, and I know you're sick, but thank you so much for everything. I really, really appreciate it. And I just wanted to wish all of you a fabulous holiday weekend. And thank you again for being on the show. And for those of you doing the 30 and 30, go get painting.
Yes, absolutely.
That's all I can say.
Wonderful.
Take care. Thanks again.
Sure. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.